Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's December 1st, 2019, and welcome to episode 204 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and cats meowing in the background. Awesome. I'm your host, Earl Evans, and we're also going to talk about which video games are timeless today. But before we do that, let me have someone send me a message on my phone.
Yay! This has been a day of wonderful.
Oh, this is a lot of fun. For those of you who don't happen to follow us on Twitter, we tried to go live today on YouTube, and it didn't work. Apparently, a failure in the streaming service that we use. Not sure. Still trying to figure it out. But we didn't go live, and now we're a little salty. But, you know, we're going to record anyway, because the show must go on. So let me go around our square table and see how people are doing. Paul, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine. I'm waiting for the snow to start falling. I decided to record from home today, which doesn't matter now that you can't see the mess behind me. But you might hear, you know, like snow removal equipment going by and screeching tires and crashes and sadness outside.
Actually, that'd make for pretty good radio. I kind of hope some of that happens now. Sorry, Paul. Sorry to your neighbors.
Well, I'm okay. I'm in here. Sorry to the people who are crashing and sad.
All right. Well, what mayhem is going on in your neck of the woods, Carrington?
Snow!
Wow. Okay.
That's all I got. I got snow. There's so much snow. It started with sleet, became freezing rain. It's currently snowing. Because God hates Canada. I don't know what we did, but my goodness, today is a day of weather, and I'm inside, and I'm going to stay here.
Well, we're all safely sequestered where we need to be, outside of the crashes and the weather. I actually had a little bit of, like, sleet come down this morning, but it's not quite cold enough to snow yet. But we're getting there. I could tell, you know, when the raindrops sort of slow down, it looks like everything's in slow-mo, and you're like,
Do you get a lot of snow in Portland?
Not a lot.
I didn't think you got any.
No, we do get some. And when it happens here, the city kind of shuts down because we have no clue how to handle snow.
Yeah, you wouldn't have the infrastructure for it. We can get a ton of snow here in Toronto, and everybody still has to go to work. that's life with salt.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Cities that do tend to see a lot of snow know how to deal with it, and we don't. And so, yeah, you don't even go down the street when it snows, let alone to work. Hey, Jack, is it snowing where you are?
It's not snowing right now, but there is snow on the ground. I was away for 3 weeks. I was in the U.S., just got back to Stockholm yesterday, and came back to find some snow, a little hard, crunchy snow, but it's not snowing now. It's just hovering right around freezing.
Okay. So. Well, what about mayhem? Any mayhem?
No mayhem. Usually, usually when it does first snow and freeze and stuff, there is some mayhem. Especially whenever Stockholm gets a big snow, which doesn't even happen necessarily once a year, but when it does, it's like suddenly things are crazy. Like, oh my God, we have to get rid of snow. Like, it's something that you think they would count on having the equipment for, because they know it's going to happen probably at least once every year, a big, big snowfall. But sometimes just like, nope, it's just like, just crazy.
So kind of the same as here in Portland. When we get it, it's just craziness. Yeah. Yep. And the other thing we get here sometimes is the freezing rain, and that's even worse. Mm. Yeah. I mean, snow you can deal with, but the freezing rain, there's just almost nothing you can do. It's one big skating rink, the entire city. Yep. So, all right, well, enough about the weather. Let's talk about video games. Video games is something that you can do indoors when you're having weather. So, see, that was an excellent segue. So, we're going to talk about which video games are timeless. And the reason we're talking about that is because one of our partners in crime, Ken Gagne, wrote an article, which Apple II games are timeless, on his Apple IIbits blog. But we're going to do, you know, super extendo and talk about video games for whatever retro platform. It could be a console, it could be a 8-bit computer, it could even be like one of the, you know, early whiz-bang 16-bit computers. I don't care. Do what you want. But we're going to go around the table, we're going to talk about this, and, you know, there will be points awarded afterwards. So, Carrington, why don't you start? And as you do, think about it like this. What sort of old video games might be something that today a kid might still enjoy by whatever your definition is of kid?
I like it. Kids are stupid, and so therefore simple. No, okay.
So whatever.
No, that is how I thought about it.
Multiplication games on a slide rule.
Exactly. A lot of games a lot of vintage games are interesting enough that somebody would, nowadays, if they were just introduced to them or a kid was introduced to them today, they say, oh, that's kind of neat. They'd sit down and they'd play it for a few minutes. A lot of Atari 2600 games are like that. They were like that at the time. They're like that now. Minutes of enjoyment. But I was thinking more about, like, what are the games that you could expose somebody to, young person or whatever, now, as their first exposure? Like, here's a game unedited exactly as it was before, and it would grip them for some time. Like, there's a chance they would sit down and play it multiple times and come back to it or play it for hours, that sort of thing. I think a couple of the games that Ken had chosen would have been on my list as well. Like, two of the games that jumped out immediately for me were Lode Runner and Prince of Persia. The original games of both of those, I think, completely hold up exactly as they were, exactly with the same graphics. Lode Runner in particular, I think, doesn't benefit at all by the subsequent changes and other versions. It's a game you could just say, here it is, exactly it is, to play on your phone or computer or whatever, and could grip somebody for hours and they'd want to go through all the various levels. I think if it's a game I was exposed to today, it would strike me that way as well. Prince of Persia, the same thing. I think it's amazing. Like, just a seamless, perfect game that would be as enjoyable today as it was back then. A couple other games that are even simpler, I think, would hold up and do seem to hold up. One of them being Tetris. Just such an iconic game. Doesn't benefit by any new things. That music is still an earworm. The gameplay is perfect as it is. Great portable thing, great on computers, great to do instead of working, whatever. So I think it's a terrific one. And Snake, if you've got a Nokia phone or even another platform, that game in its various incarnations on various platforms, I think weirdly simple, but will hold people's interest. Now, will somebody play Snake for 20 hours? Probably not. But it's timeless in that it's a pick-up-and-play game, and a variant of that I think is as fun now. But Tetris, definitely somebody could invest hours into that now. Doom is another one I thought of, because apparently everybody wants to play it on everything ever, so it always gets ported. Like, it's everything. Everything has Doom. Doesn't hold up as well for me, but apparently is super timeless. Text Adventures, Infocom games in particular, I love them now. I'm playing a lot of them for Eden by Gru now and never played them back in the day, so they're apparently timeless, at least for me, and so therefore at least for some other people. And then two other games that have proven to be timeless for me because I was introduced to them more recently in my life. I never played them back in the day. One was the RPG Wasteland, and I adored it, and it became one of my favorite gaming experiences of all time. And I played that well past the 80s and completely loved it. I've thought about it many times since then and will no doubt return to it. And I invested crazy number of hours in completing that game. And another one with terrible graphics, but for some reason just hooked me immediately in its low polygon goodness, was Alone in the Dark. So the first three Alone in the Dark games, which are quasi 3D, you know, 6 polygons on screen, can't tell the way you're facing, just like struggled like crazy, but could not stop playing them. Immediately became addicted to those 3 games and played right through them. They've got that spookiness that I like, the kind of right amount of creepiness, and Cthulhu is going to come jump out at you any second. And just, for some reason, I adored them. So Alone in the Dark and Wasteland are apparently for me timeless, but Lodrunner, Prince of Persia, Snake, and Tetris would be my picks for timeless for everybody.
Wow. I think you have some great picks there. I could see those being interesting on into the future even. And I think you're right about Doom. I could swear that I saw a YouTube of somebody who had ported Doom to a digital camera or something like that recently. So it's like, you know, play it on your watch.
Yeah, it's on everything.
Wherever, yeah. So
I think I saw a port to an oscilloscope.
Mm-hmm. Oh gosh, and we were talking recently how it plays on the touch bar for right. MacBook Pros. Like it's on everything. I think part of that is just the fun of trying to get it to run on everything, but part of it is because it's kind of iconic. I was always a Marathon person, so I prefer the Marathon series to Doom and Quake and all of that. But that is just me.
Awesome. What about you, Jack? What video game or games do you think are timeless?
Well, I've got a few that came to mind. It's interesting that Carrington said Lodrunner, because I was also thinking of that, but I was thinking about Jumpman, which I've talked about many times. And like presentation-wise, they're both games that kind of look similar. It's a little dude running around on these like girder world, avoiding enemies and stuff, but a totally different gameplay. But it's a thing where there's so much creativity and so much different stuff going on in every level of the game that it's always like, what. I guess once you've played through all 30 or 50 levels or whatever, it's not that much new to it. But while you're playing it, there is sort of this thing of you never sort of get the feeling of, oh, yeah, I've already done this. It's always something new. There's always something kind of new happening as you go through it. But another one I thought about, a lot about is this thing called Mule, which was made first the Atari 8-bit, ported to the C64, ported to NES, and according to Wikipedia, ported to IBM PC Junior specifically. Weirdly, never ported to the Apple II. Like, it's, I mean, graphically, it certainly could have done it. There's no great magic here graphically. But what it is, for those who hadn't played it, it's a game where it's a strategy game that has like economic simulation elements, where it's about kind of like you have a board where you get to sort of pick plots of land and choose. Okay, I will farm this land, or I will try and make a mine here to get some kind of ore out of this, or I will do something else with it. And so there's a time element, but there's also sort of like you make choices and you let those choices play out over time, over turns that pass. And it's kind of a lot of what's going on in Mule. It could almost just be a board game. So like in a sense, it's almost like you could imagine this, most of it, as a board game, and it wouldn't be totally crazy. Like if someone had invented the idea behind Mule 30 years earlier as a board game, like that would have totally been, yeah, this is a game. And like, so it's a lot of these stuff that is about a computer are things that would be super tedious or annoying to do in a board game, right? So it handles all the sort of like, you know, the timing, and you can do things like one of the elements of the game is when you have an excess of something you want to sell, you can have sort of an open marketplace where, okay, I'm going to sell, and I set my sell price by setting my joystick up and down. The other players can use their joystick to up and down to adjust their buy price. And when you hit the same target, then you can sell. And so while that's going on at the same time, 2 players can decide to collude by pressing their buttons at the same time. So if you and a buddy are playing and there are 2 computer players, you can say, screw those computer players, I'll give you the good price, and not lock those guys out.
Because if there's anything this Star Wars prequels taught us, a space adventure is much better with more discussion of economics.
Exactly. No, but it's a cool game, and I think that it is just as engaging now as it ever was. Last time I fired it up, I played through a whole game, and it took a number of hours, and just like I was just hooked right back in again. It was just sort of, there's like, I don't know, there's something there. I feel like there's something timeless about it. As far as other things from the 80s, I don't know. I think a lot of the games from my childhood are, like you say, Karen, they're things that were, they have a few minutes of really good play value in them, some of them. And some of them it's like, yeah, well, I've you know, done that now. Seen that, done that. There's not much more to do to it. Like, you know, a lot of the 2600 games, they're pretty simplistic, many of them. And a lot of other, some other games that from the time were, you know, even though I sat and played them, in retrospect, it feels like they were hardly worth the load time that it took to load them off of a disc, you know? It's just, I don't know. So I'm going to stick with Mule. Mule is my primary timeless game I will choose for today.
Awesome. And I've always wanted to play that, and I have not actually fired it up. And I understand it's a lot more interesting if you're playing it with a group of friends. Like, you know, on the Atari 8-bit, do they have it for that platform? Because I could swear they had it where you could do like four players because you had four joystick ports.
Yeah, definitely. It came out in the Atari 8-bit first, actually. So if you played it on an Atari 400 or 800, you could play with four people, which I did a few times back in the day, and it was a lot of fun.
Nice. So, Paul, what's your pick or picks?
Well, many of the ideas that I had. But I mean,
why we should coordinate. Yeah. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, I think, I mean, so I guess I think a little bit about the games that I would play now, you know, that I feel have a kind of a replayability that I, you know, so thinking about games that I used to play, I used to play a lot of Castle Wolfenstein. That is a terrible game.
Oh, I tried to play that recently. Like, my goodness.
I can't imagine playing that now. But I think, you know, the ones like Snake, or Tetris even, where it sort of feels like, you know, there's not a lot of new puzzles to solve or anything. It's just you feel like you made an error and you could maybe not make that error next time you play.
Mm-hmm.
That is the kind of thing that gets you going back, I think. I mean, I guess like one type of game that had that feeling for me, I know, was Bolo. And I don't know if that, you know, I don't think that went to a lot of different platforms. Yeah. But it existed in a very large procedurally generated maze. So it was, the maze was different every time. It was smooth even for like one megahertz game, you know, so it was actually sort of fun to play. It felt quick, like an arcade game. And there's a lot of the coordination. You have a tank that you can move in however many directions that is, eight, I guess, but a turret that you can also, you know, spin and shoot in those eight directions as well. You know, so it had a fair amount of coordination, but it was still kind of fun. And it only took a tap on the wall to blow you up. So, you know, the error was yours. Anyway, so I don't know. That's not a very like broadly known game, but I think that might be one of the ones that I would say, you know, like a kid could pick up and keep going.
I think that's an excellent choice. Yeah, I only recently found out about that game. Within a year or two ago, I think, is the first time, maybe more recently, I discovered the game, played it probably through the 4EM collection, something like that, and was immediately hooked. I thought it was one of the best Apple II games I've played. It was, I can't believe that never occurred to me. That's a great choice. That was like a fantastically enjoyable game that I've come back to a bunch of times since I discovered it. I thought you were talking about the Mac game. There was that Macintosh game called Bolo, like a multiplayer tank game, which was also super fun.
Oh, yeah. I think I have seen that. So Bolo must mean something. Like, that must be a word that exists outside of computers.
Yeah, it was a series of...
It's a little tie, right?
The giant tank. Wasn't Bolo... It was a series of books, sci-fi books from the 70s, mm-hmm. about, like, a giant tank. I'm pretty sure that's the giant tank thing, and the giant tank was called Bolo, and, like, the little tanks were something. I don't know. I think there were desktop, like, tabletop games in that world as well. I'm pretty sure people are screaming at their headphones right now. Like, how can you not know this? But I'm pretty sure 1970s giant tank books.
So. Yeah, that sounds reasonable. And I think, you know, so the other kinds of things that I tend to pick up, you know, just when I'm looking for something to do for a second on an Apple II, at least, or an old computer, would be like, Serpentine was another one that I think that went around. I think that was on Atari too. It's kind of a Pac-Man like game, but there are enemies. Well, I guess Pac-Man has enemies too. But I mean, like, there's a little intricacy to the gameplay. If all your other snakes that you're chasing will lay an egg, but when they lay an egg, then it makes them shorter, and you can confront other snakes head on if you are longer than them. And if you eat one of their eggs, you get longer. But if you get down to one segment, you die. And you can chase the other snakes and sort of eat their, you know, you go a little bit faster than they do. So you can sort of eat them until they are one segment. And I don't know. It's there's actually, you know, as I'm going talking through this, there's a fair amount of complexity to it, but it doesn't take long to grasp, and it's pretty fun, pretty fast, pretty replayable.
It
has
levels
like Pac-Man too. But
I played that game like an endless number of times as a kid. It was one of my favorite games. I played it thousands of times. I didn't buy it. So I'm that guy. One of the best games, one of my favorites of childhood, but never once even occurred to me maybe I should give somebody some money for it. Thank you for the stolen game. I was part of the problem. That was a great game. I remember seeing it on eBay once. It came up. It was like a green folder type. Like it would have come in a baggie. And it was one of those times where you see something, you think, oh, is that what the package looked like? But I had the game, like everybody else, a stolen, cracked version of it, and I adored it. It was just a crazily good game. That's an excellent choice.
It has on the package. It has a pretty. I also didn't own it as a kid, although I have it now, but. The painting on the package is very epic. You know, these, you know, worms attacking each other and stuff, or snakes, I guess, but pretty cool.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'll leave it at that.
Well, I love all these choices. I'm going to do a plus one for Jumpman. One of the things that I like about Jumpman is even if you do manage to work your way through all the different puzzle levels, you can also change the speed of the Jumpman, and it also changes the speed of the little bullets that shoot at you or the little robots that come after you, and it changes up the whole game dynamic. So, I mean, even if you get through all the levels, then just amp it up to 11 and try it again, and it's a lot of fun. My two favorites, I think stand the test of time really well. One is just dead simple, and that's Space Invaders. I mean, just, you know, you got the little guys shifting from left to right, coming down to destroy you, and you're just shooting at them. I mean, it's so brainless, but you can see just anybody will just pick up the joystick and start shooting the ships, and, like, you know, they get it. They just get right into it. And we'll play it for a while. I mean, probably not for hours, but, you know, it's still fun today. The other one, kind of on the other end of the spectrum of complexity, called Star Raiders for the Atari 8-bit computers. And when Star Raiders came out, it was kind of a killer app, in a sense, for the Atari 8-bits. The first time you saw the game, you know, back in the late 70s, early 80s when this came out, late 70s, right? For Star Raiders. Yeah.
Yep.
It was like nothing you'd seen before on an 8-bit system, flying through a 3D star field, moving around and shooting at enemies with their bullets coming at you in 3D. It just had a completely different feel than any of the platformers or other things that you'd see like that. And it had a good amount of strategy and complexity, too, because you have to warp around the galaxy to different star bases that are getting attacked. You also have to make sure you refuel every now and again, or you're just going to run out of fuel and be dead in the water. And so there's some strategy as well as just some good shoot 'em up action. So that's my pick for, you know, one that really, in kind of all ways, you could still pick up today and have a lot of fun with. Kind of to prove my point, on RetroBits, way back at episode 82 of RetroBits, I decided I was going to drag my son in for a cameo appearance, and we actually did a playthrough of Star Raiders while he was giving his impression. At the time, he was just 10 years old, so I was like, let's see how, you know, a young man would enjoy this game, and he really dug it.
Yeah, but I've found the exact same thing with that game. I introduced my youngest and a friend to it, and they sat there and played it for hours.
Yeah.
And then a few days later, they're like, hey, Dad, you pull the Atari out? We want to play that some more. So it's like they really, really dug it. And I wanted to point out along this vein, there is a current work in progress iOS version of a game that is very similar in spirit, and it's based on Star Raiders, that is called Xylon Defenders. So it's a modern technology thingy that you can, it's actually on GitHub, you can just grab the source code, or you can get on the beta if you have iOS, you can ask the guy to be on one of his beta testers, he'll put you on the thing, you can grab it. And it's super fun. It plays a lot like Star Raiders does, but it's a nice modern package. But it doesn't sort of add, it doesn't add a lot of extra stuff. It has pretty much the same elements you're used to in Star Raiders, just in a fresh modern app.
Cool.
Yeah, that's neat. That'd be fun to give it a shot.
Yep, it's pretty cool. I've been watching it for a while. He started working on it, I think the first beta came out over a year ago, and he kind of paused for a while, then he's been getting back up to speed on it. So I've been playing it once every couple months or so as it progresses, as I notice a new version comes out.
Mm-hmm.
It's really cool.
Excellent. Well, all right. Any parting shots before we move on to the next topic? That was really fun.
That was fun.
I'm sure there's ones we didn't think of that people can write in and say, I can't believe you didn't mention whatever. And somebody will mention Oregon Trail and we'll laugh at them.
Well, yeah, I could. Like, there were many things that I did not say.
Right.
Well, if people have those ideas, though, please write in. Feedback at rcrpodcast.com. We'd love to hear about it. We'll talk about it on the next episode.
I have an unpopular opinion, which is I think Choplifter is one that doesn't hold up. Haha. Game I love and loved back then and play frequently now. But I think if you handed that to a kid nowadays, they'd play it and enjoy it for less than 20 minutes. I think they'd really dig it and they wouldn't come back to it.
I think you're right. You know, that was one of my favorite games on Apple II. And now when I go back to it, I'm like, oh, boy, yeah.
Like, I still really like it. Like, I think it's a very good game, but I don't think it would hold up for a brand new audience if they got it today and I'm an Apple II and they think, okay, this is fun, but I'm going to play something else now.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. We'll see. But that's my unpopular opinion on this topic.
So well, that's okay.
Not so unpopular.
We had to have one controversial thing in there. So if you completely disagree with Carrington, then write in and let us know.
Right. One thing that I would maybe mention that's sort of similar, perhaps, I was going to say, well, of course, Pac-Man, that holds up. But I think Pac-Man and Space Invaders actually have the same kind of problem that bothers me now, at least, which is that it's fun to play it, but I do not want to play it a second time, because by the time I get done with the first game, it's moving quickly. And then when I start the next one, suddenly it's like, oh, this is going to take a half hour.
Slows way down again. Yeah.
And that's not fun anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so I stop and I do something else.
Interesting.
And in fact, actually at Kansas Fest, they have a Ms. Pac-Man Galaga machine. And, but I know the turbo code. So
I was just thinking the
always
same thing.
Do that.
Yep.
Like I always put that in because it is not fun to play. You know, I like Ms. Pac-Man a lot, but it's not fun to, you know, sit there for 20 minutes getting to whatever it is, level 5, before that starts getting interesting.
And Turbo Ms. Pac-Man is ridiculously fun. I really enjoy playing that at Kansas Fest.
And cheat codes are definitely your friend when you've played something 217 times.
And still aren't good at it, like me.
All right. Well, write in. Let us know what your favorite video games are that you believe will stand the test of time. And speaking of writing in, Paul, do we have some listener feedback? Who's talking to us?
We have a ton, partly because I've been not very good at keeping up with it. But so I'll go through some portion of that ton. Randall wrote on Facebook. He said that discussion of the hidden Commodore 64 program on the inner track of an album reminded him of, there was a, what's this, Retro Man Cave, two-part video on software on vinyl records. So if you wanted to take a look at that, he sort of goes through, these are generally ones where it was actually marked as being on there, not hidden, but there's a little bit of discussion of how software is, you know, on, was put on this format and so forth, and it's pretty interesting to look at. I skimmed through it. I haven't actually watched it, but is this something you're familiar with? I know Retro Man Cave is one of, at least Earl, one of your channels you watch.
I was trying to remember if I've seen these, and I think I'm going to have to go watch them because I've seen a YouTube or two about the computer games on vinyl, but I don't know if I've seen them on the RMC channel. So yeah, I'll go take a look.
All right. Well, thanks, Randall. Quinn wrote on Twitter to tell us that 14.322 megahertz is the crystal frequency in the Apple II. That value subdivides evenly into the NTSC carrier frequency and the 1.023 megahertz CPU clock frequency. So you recall there was this, the WASFest 14.25045. We repeatedly wondered, what is this number? 14.25045 is the PAL version of 14.322 megahertz. And Quinn finished that off by saying, you could say that the Apple II runs, and then she tagged 14 megahertz. I'm sure that's not what she meant, but I thought it was kind of funny.
I thought it was funny, too. And it's no surprise that Quinn knows stuff that we don't. Whatever.
But it's good to know what it was. That's for sure. And actually, we probably could have figured that out by reading the original announcement, but I never did quite do that. Now it's over. Beej wrote on Twitter regarding episode 203, the previous one, saying that the cutoff years for servicing has to do with liability, so that if someone brought in like a Mac that was whichever it was, vintage or obsolete or whatever it was, that they could break it during repair and they wouldn't be able to replace it for the customer. That's
a good point.
Beej's idea. And let's see. Beej actually also wrote on Twitter regarding computer store memories, saying, I spent massive amounts of time and money in Nibbles and Bytes in Tacoma, Washington, all through the 1980s. They sold Commodore, Atari, Laser, and Amiga hardware, plus tons of software for IBM, Apple II peripherals, and accessories for all makes, and so forth. That sounds glorious to me.
Mm. It really does.
Oh, it was, you know, so I worked in computer retail in the 80s, and it was fun being on the other side of the table, too. You'd see the regulars coming in, and, you know, they'd buy stuff sometimes they wouldn't, but it was always such a joyous experience. They'd be coming in and like, ooh, what new goodies have you got, you know, and you'd show them the latest software, the, you know, what new peripheral thing had come out, and, you know, some of the people kind of got to know each other, and then user groups would form, and it was like good times. So always love hearing reminiscing about that.
Yeah, yeah. Quinn at some point had also tweeted us. I didn't mark this down here, but she apparently has stories. Oh, has she stories? And actually, there's let's see if I can find it. But I just recently was catching up on Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It podcast, and he talked a bit about, I think it was I should probably get this right, Mr. Hernandez, I think it is. Yes, Mr. Hernandez, who was the person at the computer store near him. So that was kind of a neat little reminiscence about, you know, sort of the place of computer stores and at least his personal history and a lot of our personal histories. Let's see. Okay, so Tobias wrote a multi-tweet thing to us. He said that it would be fun to talk more in depth about the Chip 8, and I don't know very much about it. But what I do know, I know from this tweet storm that he sent. So he said Chip 8 actually wasn't a physical chip, but an interpreter, or now you would say a bytecode VM, which lets you write and run programs, games mostly, without doing any 1802 machine code. So just 37 instructions, really easy to use. The Chip 8 computer that has been made now is a physical manifestation of that interpreter, which originally ran on the 1802 and later on many other architectures. And he says, let's see, nowadays Chip 8 runs on anything, although after the 1802 it became famous on the HP 48 calculators. It is a common Hello World project for people who are getting into writing emulators since it's such a small virtual architecture. And perhaps more interesting than all of that, he said every October there's a small group that do a game jam to make new Chip 8 games because there are orders of magnitude more Chip 8 interpreters than there are games.
But also it was really cool. He gave us a link and I went over and looked and there's a video on there where you can see some videos of some games for the Chip 8 and they're like some really interesting ones that I want to think they're timeless is what I'm saying.
Oh yeah. Mm. Yeah. So I'll have to check that out, you know, more thoroughly. I didn't follow that link, but I mean, I did follow it and it was purple and that was as far as I got, but, but look, it's very pleasing colors. Kind of reminds me of yogurt.
Yep.
Sometimes I see cars. There's a car paint color that looks like this, and I always immediately think blueberry yogurt.
You know, as soon as you say that, I'm like, I know exactly the color you're talking about. There is that particular blueberry yogurt color. My gosh, that's amazing. Yeah. Anyway. The home I had maybe 2 or 3 places ago that I lived, I decorated in sensory things. Like I would decide something that had like a strong sense memory for me, and I would pick something for each room. And my dining room, I painted in the color of hockey arena vending machine hot chocolate. And so I went and got a cup of hot chocolate and took it to a place that can like use a sensor and mix you up paint that exactly matches that. So I went and got a bunch of hot chocolates. The one that tasted and smelled the most like I remembered as a kid, I then put in a thermos and brought to this place. They put it in a little glass and then I got to paint my dining room that color. And it brought me great joy. So some colors are awesome.
And it gave you a good story and very little resellability.
What it gave me was a very dark dining room that I had to repaint to get rid of that home. That's what it gave me. But I enjoyed it while I was there. But it was, yes, it was like, let's eat inside this walnut. It was a very dark room. But I dug it.
Blake wrote on Byte Seller, he was inspired by our episode 200 about how he got started in vintage computing. And so he wrote a little essay about his start, sort of starting with the Atari VCS and getting a TI-99/4A in 1982. And then apparently he also fell into this hole by, like, also meaning like I did, fell into the hole by buying an Apple II GS. But he fell into a much more organized hole than I did. So he's got little pictures of his Byte Seller, you know, the actual place that the blog is named after. And
There's a great photograph link to that. It's from a few years ago, I think. It's like not the current setup, but there's that great panorama photo he has that is just such a nice setup.
Yeah.
Mm. Like it's one of those great things where he's got a whole bunch of vintage computers, but it's kind of like a living computer museum where they're all set up and can be usable. So it's not just stacked around and piled. It's like, what do I feel like playing with today? And they're just like plopped down in front of it, ready to go. It's a great setup.
Yeah. Probably made a actual noticeable dent in the electricity bill having them all on for that photo.
People should read the Byte Seller. If it's a thing, they'll have the link, obviously, to this post. But if you don't read Byte Seller, you totally should. Everything on there is always amazing. It's like one of my go-to places. Something gets posted, I immediately read it.
Another thing that came up recently, I forget when, but I think it was maybe the previous episode, was the Coleco Atom. I had found I didn't get it, by the way, but I'd found a eBay auction for one that was kind of nearby, but it was missing the printer.
Oh, but it was missing the printer, right? You said that's how they get powered.
Yeah. And so Eric over email pointed us to a YouTube video of someone named AKBKUKU. Who has a YouTube video called Making a New Coleco Atom Internal Power Supply Unit. And I have not watched it all the way through, but the point of it is to solve the problem that was identified there. So this is basically just sort of like, I assume, what you do to get your Atom running without the printer.
I think the person's name is actually Shelby.
Okay.
To GitHub. But it's important to know that it's capital A, small k, capital B, capital K, small u, small k, capital U, whatever. I'm saying Shelby. Yeah. Come on, man. What is that supposed to stand for? Maybe it means something to people who understand it, but I don't understand it.
Yeah. Well, hopefully it doesn't mean something offensive.
I hope it does.
But at any rate, that's cool. I will.
Yeah, that is very cool.
Because I actually do. I sort of like the idea of getting an Atom at some point, but because they are kind of cool looking, and even when the keys are not all weirdly yellowed in strange ways, they are still interesting looking. They're different shades of brown and tan stuff. It's kind of nice. It's sort of an autumnal look.
Okay.
Are there floppy drives for the Atom, or was it only cassettes and cartridge?
I believe a floppy drive existed, but not by default.
Right.
Because one of the fun things about that Atom is those two front little cassette thingies or whatever. It's part of the look of the Atom. Like how I know it's an Atom, when you see it and go, hey, what's with the dual cassette front thing or whatever? Like it's a strange looking computer.
I vaguely recall too that they had there was some sort of like higher density way to put the data on the cassettes. I might not be remembering that right. But
well, cassettes are so reliable. What you want to do is put even more data per inch on them. That's a great idea.
Yes.
Because it's super fun to load something that takes 30 minutes and then says, no, try again.
Right. Okay, so let's see. The next thing, Bob wrote over email a while back to tell us about Turbo Rascal syntax error, semicolon expected but begin. which is the name of, it is the actual name of a Commodore 64 development environment that you can
It rolls right off the tongue, too.
Yep.
Turbo Rascal syntax error, semicolon expected but begin. Abbreviated as just TRSE. But anyway, I very much like the name, but it seems like it's pretty impressive, too. It says, what's the bullet points? A semi-full functional Pascal-like compiler that compiles to DASM assembler files, built-in assembler, optimizer. So it has a library and some, you know, some other stuff that kind of helps you out in structuring your program, as well as also having an editor and a sprite editor, text editor, that kind of thing. So if you were into this, Earl, are you into this? Have you seen this?
I haven't tried it out yet. I'm both enthusiastic about Pascal and the Commodore, obviously, but I haven't put the two together to try this out yet.
Yeah, I would. Just on the name alone, I think it deserves a try.
Indeed. Yeah. If you're going to write that many characters, I'll go ahead and run it at least once.
You know, and as I look at this, I believe that I probably said every single time, because I had Pascal in mind, I probably called this Turbo Rascal. When, of course, no one would say that. It's a rascal, right?
Yep. Turbo Rascal, for sure.
That's cool. What's left here? James wrote over email. Oh, yeah, he was asking a question that I don't know the answer to, but I can ask it, which is, when is recapping an Apple computer needed? So this is sort of specifically targeting Apples of various eras. Like, what are the ones that are most likely to be failing? So
SE30.
Yeah, SE30 is definitely.
Yeah, and weirdly, I think the SE and the SE30 are different. My memory is the SE has, like, solid caps, or something like that, and the SE30 are the surface-mounted ones or whatever, and they're going to leak all over the place. Like, there's certain computers that are kind of notorious for you should proactively recap them. SE30 was like that. I think the Color Classic is like that. A bunch of the Quadras, the Quadra 660 and 840, like those ones, I think those also end up getting a lot of cap damage. Like, there's ones that are, I think, kind of famously unreliable for their caps. Those are the ones that jump out.
Right.
So SE30, definitely yes. SE seems to be one you don't have to as often.
Well, and I'm going to say anything, Apple or otherwise, with a RIFA cap in there, the RIFA caps, those things, if you've ever had one of those blow on you and had to put up with the worse than a skunk smell that lingers for weeks, then you know you're going to want to recap anything that has one of those in it, just period, full stop. Because the one that I had go out on me was an Apple II GS, and it was amazingly smoky and amazingly stinky, and they're such a common failure point that they're a pretty good idea, from what I understand, to just recap. Mm. Now, your mileage may vary, and I'm not responsible if you destroy your machine trying to recap it, but I'm just telling you, man, don't let one of those blow up on you. It is not pretty.
Yeah. Yeah, I was looking at this list, and I saw Apple IIe and Apple IIgs, and I was thinking, well, no, those actually probably don't need recapping, but you're right. I wasn't thinking about the power supply, and the RIFA caps are usually in the power supply. If you have an Apple III, Apple IIe, Apple IIgs, I think any of the Apple II power supplies have these. And so
there's also newer power supplies. If you're not like sold on it being original stuff, you can just get a new power supply for them, which might be easier if you don't want to recap stuff.
That's definitely what I would do.
Yeah, that's a good point, because then you get the better quality power supply as well as preempting any kind of issue with the capacitors, and they're not that expensive.
For the listeners at home, this is how I sneakily talk them all into going all emulation. Stay tuned.
Step one complete.
Step one. Mwah.
Yeah. The next, I think probably all the Next hardware was in that era, the same era that had all the bad Mac capacitors too. And the Apple IIe card, sadly, is among those things that.
Oh, I did not know that.
It has these capacitors and they leak.
Ah, so. I love the Apple IIe card. It's one of my favorite products.
Yeah.
Well, it wasn't my product. I really shouldn't take credit.
Anyway, it's a good question. I don't know that that counted as a definitive answer, but that's what all of what we've said here, you know, sort of matches what
all
I've
the computers
heard.
All the time. Yes. except not the SC30 and not the SC versus the SC30. And the only way I know that, I think, is I had an SE back in the day, and I only had an SC30 much later, like as a retro thing for a short time. So I have nostalgia for the SE. So I'm always kind of rooting for the SE, even though everybody wants the SC30.
Right, right. I think even some of the later ones, like the Powermac G4, G3, or something like that, also had. There was someone, they were talking about this on Retro Maccast actually sometime recently, and now I forget exactly what the machine was, but it was something that was hard to get into, and it had like 23 capacitors or something.
Like maybe the iMac G4? Does that have them? Because that one's a tough one to get into. I hope not, because that's maybe my grail computer. I've never had one, and I really want one. But there's a particular one I want. I want the 800 megahertz 2001. Oh, listen to me, nerd out. I want that one because it's the last one, I think, or one of the last ones that could run macOS 9 natively, which I'd rather do than in classic mode. So that's the sweet one for me.
So the iMac G4, that's the one that on RetroMacCast they call the lumpstick rectangle.
I think of it as like the most Pixar looking computer. I just love the form factor, man. I just think they're gorgeous, and how the tray comes out, it looks like a tongue sticking. I love it. I love the ad for it. I love everything about it. And I have like serious nostalgia for a computer I never owned. And it's that one.
But it is true. It is really hard to get into. And then getting into it actually involves like de-sticking some kind of, there's some sort of like thermal paste.
I hate having to put thermal paste back on.
Yeah.
Or putting new stuff on. It always just scares me. I'm going to do it wrong.
Yeah. Well, the advantage, you know, if you have 15 of them,
then... I guess less of an issue for you, but I never want 15 of anything.
I don't think I have 15, but I think I have 8. So I had this idea at one point, because they actually fit nicely on a shelf. I had them all lined up, and I had this idea that I would sort of network them together, and I would have some little, like, ball or something that would go from one screen to the next.
You know, that'd be great. No, you have to have them all, because they're on that base that rotates. I've touched them before, so I know they've got that sort of, and so you could get them on some sort of mechanical plate or whatever, so people come to your office, they all turn to look at the person. That would be amazing.
Somehow make it look like they're frowning or looking quizzically, cock their head to the side. Yes. Very good.
You can't do that with emulation. That's a reason to go real hardware.
Yeah. Anyway, that's more than enough of the feedback that we got. Thank you, everybody, for writing. And if I've missed something, I hope I will get back to it.
Yeah. Yeah. I love the feedback. Thank you. And now we can move into the items of interest. And I think the first one is Carrington. So, Carrington, give us your best Santa Claus.
I love this. Co-co-co. Merry Christmas. So there's a thing coming out. And I don't know if this is something that happens every year. This is just the first one I've heard of. It's the 2019 Coco Christmas DVD. So the Coco Christmas 2019 DVD, it says, will be jam-packed with Coco goodies. It may contain music, videos, Windows PC software, Coco virtual disks, Coco Ride binary files, data files, photos, who knows what. Why may? Because it's going to be collected together. Up until December 10th, you can submit stuff. Submit your games, submit your stuff, submit things to do with the Coco, and then they'll all be gathered into this disc that you can then pick up, I think, at a local, I think it's $19, something like that. So $19 disc. It's kind of like a community thing. It's going to gather all this stuff together, be an 8-gig DVD or up to 8 gigs. Who knows what gets submitted? I just think it's a great idea. This is awesome. So the person putting it together, I don't know the person's name, but they're going to include a new Coco game. A Christmas-themed arcade game will be on the disc. I just think it sounds terrific. I like this whole idea. I have nothing to contribute, and I have nothing to run it on. So I don't have a dog in this fight. But I just really like it. So I wanted to bring everybody's attention to it. So if you've got some Coco stuff, videos or photos or games or anything, you could contribute to them, and then you can buy them back for $90.
It's a neat project.
Yeah, I thought cool. So too. So, and we're talking about it in time if this comes out in the next week and a half.
It didn't.
People can still submit, but even if not, you'll be able to go online and buy it and enjoy it for Christmas.
Uh-huh.
Way to go, Coco community.
Nice.
Go, go, Coco.
Go, go, Coco powers.
Excellent. They're a spunky bunch, aren't they? The cocoa lovers?
They are.
They really are.
I have such a soft spot for the cocoa. So love it. Love that they're doing this.
Excellent. All right, Jack, what's FujiNet? Is it like Fujiyama? Because I think we might have
mentioned Fujiyama.
Yeah.
It's not like Fujiyama, but it is Atari related. So we've talked before about things like Wi-Fi modems, where you have a serial connection to this device that you use AT commands to dial out. So your retro computer is on the internet instead of going through a phone line, right? Well, someone has taken this idea. Well, that someone is Thomas Cherry Holmes, who we've talked about before. He's worked on the Play-Doh emulator for all the platforms in the past year or two. So now he started this new project where his realization was, on the Atari, the port for everything is the SIO port. That's where you're going to connect serial, disk drives, cassettes, whatever you want, is all going through that. So it's much more than a serial port, right? And what he realized is we could make a device that actually works with the Atari. And so what the FujiNet device is going to do, it will let you do the modem stuff, but it will also let you, it can also act as a disk emulator based on loading a disk image over the network. So you can boot up your Atari over the internet, and he's done this. And so he's extended. And I don't know the details. I'm not that deep in the code at all. But he makes this act just like a disk drive as far as the Atari is concerned. So in one and there's a way you set it up somehow. I think there's so it's some kind of Arduino device, I think, that is built into this. And so he's got some code for that he can write in C and whatever, and that does some stuff. And then from the Atari end, it looks at that and sees that as just, oh, this is a floppy, when in fact it's been configured on the other side to pull some data from somewhere else. So it can both act as a serial port, act as a floppy drive, and act as a different type of device. So in Atari's OS, these all have letters. So a D is a disk drive, R is the RS-232 serial port, and he's created this thing called N, which is the network port. So you can create you can just sort of open a stream on the network to talk to something else. And so he's got some code and some demos doing that. There's a whole bunch of videos he's put on YouTube showing various bits of this. The source code is all open source, both software and hardware. Looks like about 8 or 10 people are working on it right now, and things are going very quickly. They're iterating on the hardware, and they're adding new software, and it's looking very, very cool.
That is wild.
I'm pretty excited about this.
It seems like it's kind of like an SIO to PC device, except over the internet, instead of being connected to like a host PC or something like that. Cool.
Yeah, so you can have your disk images available on a thing on your local network, or it can be online, and it'll just somehow do it when it's all working. But like the basic proof of concept, he has gotten working, or they have gotten working, the team's gotten working, and it's looking really, really cool. I'm really excited about this, and it's too early to talk about prices yet, but they figure that it's probably going to cost along the lines of, say, like an S Drive Max, which is say in the, I don't know, $60 to $80 range kind of thing.
Oh my gosh, that would be so worth it.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Even
this
though
seems
I have
really, really cool.
Rarely used Ataris myself, I would probably get one.
Yep, so I'm pretty excited about this.
Yeah, this idea of being able to load in images off the internet is amazing.
Right, and this is going to be able to both read and write images. So basically, if you have, as long as, I don't know how this is going to have to work on the other end of things. They said they borrowed some idea from something else. Let's see, where can I find this? The idea for how the network protocol works is loaned from some other project, some kind of spectrum thing, I think. Okay, right. The thing for mounting disk images over a protocol borrowed from the SpectraNet community called TNFS. So apparently if you have the right sort of TNFS server set up somewhere, you can set it up to allow both reading and writing. So you can actually be saving your work, saving your files or your save games or whatever over the network.
Man, that's beautiful. So probably you could run your own server at home if you want to with some of the software, and also like talk out to the internet for it too if you want to.
Yeah, because I'm just speculating here, but I imagine that once it's up and running, you'll be able to create multiple multiple D drives that are virtually mounted from somewhere else. So you might have one that is on your LAN and another one that is across the world somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And you can, at the same time, it can also do this N device, which is basically a way of just opening a network connection, essentially kind of opening a socket and sending data back and forth.
Awesome.
It seems like a lot of things are happening very quickly. There are a lot of videos going up online, and it's cool.
Neat. Well, those Atari people are kind of spunky, aren't they?
They are.
Very good. Well, Carrington, you have something about a font.
I have a terrible, terrible link because it goes to Twitter. And it's an unfortunate thing because it will go away. But we can talk about it anyway. And people who are listening to us in a relatively recent time frame, probably this year, next year, whatever, can probably click on this link and it'll work. And in the future, it'll just be gone because Twitter stinks that way. It's a really interesting thread, but a fellow who searched for the origin of a particular font. In the 1990s, there were tons of games that had a particular font in them. It was a cartoony kind of font. It appeared in lots of DOS games, particularly shareware games. Like, tons of shareware games had this font. I remember seeing this font all the time. And it was in Mortal Kombat. It was in Star Control 2, like he says. He says it's in cartoon-related license games, but mostly shareware things. He just, like, really knew this font. And just wanted to know, what was the origin of this font? So started searching for the earliest version. And one of the first versions he could find was in Electronic Arts, Deluxe Paint. So in the 1990s, there was Deluxe Paint, and it had this font in it called Comix, C-O-M-I-X. And that seemed to be the font used in all these games. And so they were all ripped off of Comix. So I said, well, okay, but did it originate in Comix? Turns out, no, it did not. Comix got it from someplace else. When you look at the font, the entire font listing inside Deluxe Paint, which is not a Macintosh game, it nonetheless contains like the Apple and the command key symbol, like all these specifically Apple related font characters, which is a really strange thing to have in a font that's only on PCs. How weird. So if you keep looking farther into the past, you can find out that it appeared on a shareware CD for Macintosh shareware, and it was called Cartoon 12. And so it in December 1986, it was on the BMUG CD, and looks like it got ripped off that from the Macintosh and used in this paint program, and then got taken from there and used in tons of games. So where did BMUG get it from? Well, it turns out they ripped it off from the game Through the Looking Glass, which is Steve Capp's program. And you might know that because that's, in a lot of ways, the very first game for Macintosh. Now, you could argue that the very first game was like that little shareware slider thing, but it's Apple's first game. So, and really is, I think, the only game that I can think of that Apple both, like in a sense, Apple made and Apple published. So there's Through the Looking Glass, super, super early game for the Macintosh, and Steve Capp made that game, and for that game created two fonts, one called Comix 12, I think, and one called Cartoon 12, something like that. And so this is one of those two fonts. And so the person on Twitter recaps is, okay, so we have basically the earliest first party Mac game. It got somehow sneaked over into a BMUG shareware disk. From there, a programmer at EA ripped it off and stuck it in Deluxe Paint on PC. And from there, a bunch of PC people stuck it in their shareware games. And nobody got sued about anything. And those Apple characters just carried their way through. Exactly. So I suspect that Apple is going to now put a lawsuit against a bunch of PC shareware games for the 1990s. I don't know. It was a really interesting thread. Like, somebody went down the rabbit hole. found like the source of this font and went back super early, and then found kind of canonically it was definitely made by Steve Capp, because he talks about how it was like over a weekend he made up the first beta for this game, and needing fonts, he handcrafted two different fonts for the game. Like, he's the person who went down and created the font that then just got ripped off, and because people were just ripping off, they just took the whole font description, including the Mac specific characters, and said, whatever, we'll just keep including it. And those just never got dropped and just went from PC shareware game to PC shareware game. They all had the character for the Apple and the command key in them for some reason. Anyway, it was a delightful thread. I just really loved it. And it's a shame the whole thing is now on on Twitter because it'll be very ephemeral. But it was a wonderful little bit of a font detective work, I thought.
Cool.
This is something that's so esoteric to go research, but so interesting that they would go through all the, you know, all the turns and twists to kind of track this down. Wow. Fascinating.
Yeah, and it definitely looks familiar to me. I mean, like, I know that font.
Yeah, me too. I saw it. I'm like, oh, yeah, sure. When you do DOSBox, you'll see this font over and over and over again. And it turns out it was ripped off from basically the first Macintosh game.
Crazy. I saw somewhere in the thread someone mentioned that it was appropriate that the author of the thread initially used ResEdit to dig into the original game to find this font and verify it, because ResEdit was also written by the same Steve Capp.
Oh, well, there you go. Nice.
Wow. Very cool.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Jack, speaking of spunky Atari people, are we talking about Prince of Persia on the Atari 8-bit?
We are.
Timeless.
It's timeless. Gary brought up earlier, and it's timeless. Someone's working on Prince of Persia on the Atari 8-bits. They have the first level apparently working all the way through. There's a video you can watch. I watched the video. It's cool. I didn't watch the whole video all the way through because I got frustrated. The guy playing kept dying at the same spot. Come on. Do better than this. Quit dying right there. But it looks really cool. It doesn't look exactly like the other platforms, of course, but it's very nicely tuned for the Atari in terms of colors and how the sprites are working and stuff. So it's really neatly done. And I think I read somewhere that this is based at least partly on an existing C64 port of Prince of Persia. So anyway, it looks very cool. And I'm excited because I've actually never played the game. I never had a classic Mac back in those days, and just it was never my thing. But maybe one day now I'll actually play it.
Doesn't hold up.
I actually also, weirdly enough, have never played it. I mean, like, maybe 20 seconds of it. But so I've seen it. I played Karateka a lot, or whatever it is you want to call that.
Right.
I want to call it Karateka. Yeah. I'm not a monster.
but at any rate, yeah. Someday I'm gonna have time to sit and play that.
It is so good. It is just crazy, shockingly, amazingly good. It's also very difficult because there's a fixed timer that plays through the game. Like, you get a certain amount of time to go and unfortunately rescue the princess, but whatever. Forget the theme. The rest of the game is really good. And so if you're not great at it and you keep dying, you can easily get many hours into this game and then simply just run out of time on level 10 or whatever and just have to start over. It's quite frustrating. So there's some more modern versions of the game. You can play iOS, etc., that let you just, like, once you get to level 2, you're just on level 2 and you can make your way through the game without having to worry about a full-on universal timer. Otherwise, the way to play it really is to get good at a level and then restart that level from your save game, so you're always using minimum time. But that can be a little frustrating. But the game itself is incredibly good. Like, just, it has some surprises in it. Great adventure, great puzzles. The graphics are actually amazing. I think they hold up. It's one of my all-time favorite games.
So the release of this source code seems to be, you know, just putting more fuel on the fire of the argument that, you know, it's such a good thing for everybody when the source code for something like this gets released. Because look how much enthusiasm it's generating with all these ports and people inspecting it and learning from it and stuff like that. It's so cool.
Yep, that's true. I think there's so much culturally good stuff that happens when things can be shared, when things are free to be shared, can openly be shared.
Mm-hmm.
Things like this, yeah, it's a great example of it.
Yep. Well, Carrington, you know, if you're feeling a little insecure, it looks like you've got the link for us.
If you thought my last link was bad, wait till you click on my new one. So this is an interesting idea. It's also not going to last or whatever, but I hadn't even thought of this before. So let's say you've got a vintage computer and you're going to connect it to the internet. How do you test it? Where can you go? Because increasingly, everything's secure. Everything's HTTPS, and most vintage ways to get on the internet don't let you connect to those. So you're just left out. You might connect to the internet, but there's nothing you can actually go to. So this person's put together a site. It seems to have originally been called Site from 90s and then got changed to Hello 90s and now is Hello Futurelings. So it's a lot of title changes for what is essentially a plain list of links, like straight out of the 90s. And this is a person who's collecting links to pages that you can connect to insecurely. So how long is this going to last? I don't know. But it's an interesting idea. So these are simple, as he puts it, simple non-HTTPS sites. How long will those be around? I don't know. But if for the moment, you get your vintage computer on the internet by some means, and you need to have a website you go to test it, you could go to this page, which is itself not secure, and it will let you leapfrog over to other pages, which are themselves not secure. Roll those dice, folks, and get on the internet. But I thought it was pretty funny. So anyway, that a link for this, and it is as bare bones as a site as you can get. Like, it is very raw HTML. I dig it. So there you go. A little bit of retro web stuff for everybody.
So I could Fantastic. I could do Mosaic and surf to this. I could. Yeah.
Yes, you can.
Navigator 1.0.
And dolekemp96.org is still online.
Yeah.
Exactly. So yep. Stuff like that.
Still looks the same. Today's headlines, November 5th, 1996.
And one of the links on this is, if you want to go to a picture-heavy website, click here. And it takes you to an amazing Norwegian website called Arngren.net, which seems to be selling electronics and weird little toy cars and motorcycles and I don't know what all. And this is the craziest layout I've ever seen on
a
website.
It's amazing.
It is so tightly packed and just like, oh my goodness, how did they do it?
And the nice thing is, there's no CSS or anything like it. It is in no way a reactive design. What's that? Everything nowadays. Yeah. Anyway, it just is like, it is what it is. Everything's laid all over the place in these weird overlapping tables. But it is dense. Dense as like an old computer shopper page.
Yeah.
It's just crazy, crazy. It's awesome.
And don't neglect to scroll horizontally also. Because there is like...
It keeps going.
It just keeps going. There's so much.
I did not
realize
that.
And on the very bottom, it's Christmas themed, so it must be keeping update or just coincidence. But it's got like great little animated graphics on the bottom of little Santa flying. It's glorious.
Yeah, I mean, they're selling drones and things and like various RC things. I guess this is new and up to date. Like, this is just like crazy bonkers layout. I've never seen anything like it. It's beautiful.
Well, and whenever I do e-commerce, I never want to use TLS, period. Straight HTTP for me, baby.
That's right. Where do I enter my credit card number here?
And my social.
I'm ready.
Especially because it's an insecure site. Best thing to do is go shopping on there.
Exactly.
That'll give you a real Black Friday. All right.
Oh, man.
All right. Well, that was some great items of interest. So now we're going to go to upcoming show roundup. And if you notice, my cat Stormy is still meowing upstairs to try and get down here. So she's nothing if not persistent. Sorry about the mewling, but we're moving on. So we've got an upcoming show roundup. Just three shows we'll talk about right now, and they're all next year. So, you know, start planning ahead. One is VCF Pacific Northwest. That's going to be in my neck of the woods, March 21st through 22nd. In Seattle at the Living Computer Museum Plus Labs. The next one we'll talk about is the 29th annual last Chicago Cocoa Fest. It's always the last, and it seems like it's never the last, and that is just so awesome. And this next year, it's going to be April 18th and the 19th, 2020, in Elk Grove Village, Illinois. And finally, VCF East, always a fun time, April 24th through 26th. 2020 at the InfoAge Center in Wall Township, New Jersey. Links for all of those will be up in the show notes. And with that, we're going to take a break for a word from our sponsor.
I like being productive, and I found a whole new way to do it. I put PC Junior to work.
Another mouth to feed? Bob. A larger Cratchit family is no excuse for a raise
Scrooge,
in pay
Mr.
now.
Mr. Scrooge, PC Junior is not human. Meet PC Junior from IBM.
A stack of boxes and wires?
It's a computer, Mr. Scrooge.
I always thought computers were as big as manor houses and twice as expensive.
Good morning to you, PC Junior.
This is yours, Bob? I can't believe it. You can't afford a computer on what I pay you.
I could afford PC Junior, Mr. Scrooge. I take the keyboard and the system unit home each night. We hook it up to the television set and everyone can use it. Why, it's become like another member of the family. Say, why don't you drop in at the house tonight to see how we all use PC Junior? That's a fine idea, Bob.
Watch out! Uncle Ebenezer, would you like to play a game with me?
Certainly, my lad. Lead on. However, I must warn you, I was once a terror at croquet.
This is the new Apple IIc. This is a computer they call Junior. You might think they're similar, but this one can only run this many programs, while the Apple IIc can run this many. The Apple comes with its disk drive built in, so it's much smaller. Even the price is small. Now, which one would you rather take home? The new Apple IIc.
Some people think the IBM PC Junior runs only about this much software. So wouldn't they be pleased to know that PC Junior runs over 50 of the most up-to-date word processing programs? Over 25 mailing lists and 50 programs for personal finance and home management. Over 300 for education programs, and hundreds more to help you do almost anything. Plus powerful new cartridge programs like Lotus 1-2-3. The truth is, PC Junior runs over 1,000 of the best, most up-to-date programs. And with its new memory expansion attachment, it can run well over 1,000 more. PC Junior from IBM, the computer that's growing by leaps and bounds.
And we're back with a host's retro computing gift idea. And this one is pretty cool because it also doubles as some feedback. Paolo of Vintage is the New Old, a website that I really love, actually sent us a link for Commodore 64 dust covers. And I think these are actually from Paolo himself, aren't they? Mm-hmm. Yeah, these are neat. A couple things that I like about it right off the bat. One is it's fabric and not plastic, which mm-hmm. I kind of feel like fabric, you know, we've talked a lot in this episode about standing the test of time. I feel like in a lot of ways, fabric will do that. Plastic will get old and brittle and peely and yucky. And, you know, these are pretty cool.
Sticky and oily.
Yeah. Ooh, yeah. That is so gross. Go up to some 80s plastic and you touch it. It's like, why are you sticky? I don't think I want to know. And then the second thing I like about it has a picture of the bread bin on top, so when you put the dust cover over the bread bin Commodore 64, you can still see the bread bin Commodore 64 underneath. And Carrington, I know that would be like super important to you for your Commodore 64 computer.
Oh, very important. It drives me crazy, though, that it doesn't exactly line up. Like it should be that
that's true.
If you're seeing through, that if I press the keys line up with the keys. Like I want it to be shifted over so it's like I'm looking through and I can actually just use the computer without taking the dust cover off.
Wow. That is a really good plus one for your sense of aesthetics, Carrington.
You are even better if it had a picture of a better computer. So like I'm ashamed of my Commodore 64, which of course I would be, and then I could cover it up and I could look down at something even more powerful like a ZX80.
I think the word you're looking for is amazed, not ashamed. So these are cool. They're on Etsy. We'll have a link in the show notes. They're 15 and 14/100 British pounds. I don't know what that translates to in U.S. dollars.
I don't know.
For me, it's showing Canadian dollars.
Yeah, for me too.
Well, I'm getting 186.80 SEK.
Really?
Now I'm in Canada.
1950 U.S. dollars.
Oh, Etsy.
Wow. How interesting. We see it. Our show is both entertaining and educational.
Mm-hmm. I did just learn something, though. I never knew the Commodore 64, like the base thing, was called a bread bin model. That's new to me.
That's the very first one. Yeah, the bread bin. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the later model, the kind of cost-reduced, slopey kind of 64C. Yeah, so that's why they refer to the originals as the bread bin. Yep. Because they kind of look like one.
And in French, it's pain.
It's kind of a pain in English.
I understand how you pronounce it, but whatever.
Close enough.
The joke is made.
Yes. The joke is excellent.
Yes. You did well, Paul. Thank you. All right. So, by the way, I'll also note, almost gone. There's only two left. So if you want one, you better get them fast because they're growing like hotcakes. So thank you, Paolo.
He did say, too, that they're going to make other computers in the future. So, and I think it says that on the note on the side of the listing, too. So even if you want something for other computers that are not a Commodore 64, keep an eye on that Etsy store.
They will all have a Commodore 64 on them.
That's true, but they will be pretty, designed.
He's pushing an agenda, but you can have them fit other computers.
And the keys still won't line up. All right, excellent. And now for more stuff we can buy, we're going over to eBay auctions. And with our first eBay auctions, it's over to Carrington first. Tell us what you got.
I got four things. The first one is a box. It's not a bread bin, but it's a box. And really all it is a box. It's a toolbox or a technician's case, but it's kind of neat because it's a Sperry Univac technician's case. So it just kind of opens at the top. Imagine like the kind of hard case suitcase style that butterflies open at the top. It's one of those. But it's caught my eye because it's $50 and it's Sperry Univac on the side. That's all it has, is really just a stencil on the side. This is Barry Univac. And it's all caps, which is, so it's, I think, going to come from a pretty specific era when it got renamed to Sperry Univac, but Univac was still all caps before they just did just capital U as if Univac wasn't short for stuff. Very weird naming that company went through. So it's just neat, but if you wanted a box, like say you just needed a toolbox or whatever, you could do worse than this one because it's kind of cool to show up with that. And this is sort of like my little bag I use to try to make friends, and you could show up at the grocery store with your Sperry Univac case, and then we would be buddies, and it would be awesome. So I'm just saying, $50, make a friend.
That's excellent. I have a Sperry Univac ashtray, but it's not as useful.
No, and you're gonna make the wrong kind of friend. The shipping on this is like $66.76 to me, so the shipping is more than the item. So I mean, I don't think it's probably worth the cost, but if you were nearby or something, I just thought it was cool. It's a very Univac case. Can't go wrong. So that's my first choice. Second choice is an auction that's already expired, but by a shipper that's or a seller that seems to have a ton of stuff and relist stuff. So hopefully it's back available again. And it caught my eye because I'm really interested in weird versions of BASIC for the Apple II, because the Apple II came with BASIC, originally Integer BASIC and the later AppleSoft BASIC, a very good BASIC built into the computer. So it seems like a strange market to create another BASIC for the Apple. Say like, here, buy this thing instead of get the one that came with the computer. So I'm always fascinated by other BASICs and what they bring to the table. A lot of times what they bring to the table is like a compiler or something like that. And reading about this one is called NBASIC, capital E, small n, capital BASIC. So just love this. But the NBASIC authoring system seems to be something along the lines of Pilot and SuperPilot. This idea that you're creating software specifically for use in a classroom. So this is a version of BASIC that has like that Pilot stuff in where you can make it pause or make it take input only using certain keys. So it adds this idea to a BASIC that you could make a test or make a little game and then say, okay, I want to take input from the keyboard, but only permit the following keys, ignore the rest of them. And then also seems to have had, when I read a bunch of reviews of this, that one thing that separated it from other BASICs that did this was it had a bunch of, you know, quote unquote, smart ability to differentiate things like inputs and take them if they're roughly correct. So you could say, get an input, and what I want is an answer that includes the word lemon. And so somebody can type a whole bunch of stuff, and you could say, only let them use the keys and the return, or the letters and the return key, and that's it. And then if the answer includes lemon anywhere in it, then it's going to be taken as correct. And so you could put a couple of different versions of something so it could get past like a little kid who's spelling something incorrectly or get weird syntax errors, and they could still enter something that is then taken as a correct answer. And it could also do markup on the answer. So somebody, say you say, what's the capital of something? They'll type their answer, and then it can display what they typed marked up using symbols that you would use if you were editing somebody's essay or something like that. So all these like abilities built into it, which is kind of strange for a BASIC, I thought. So really neat BASIC I never heard of before. This is the NBASIC authoring system. It's according to the box, the new color version, and it was a $99 opening bid on this, got no bids. I don't know if it's worth it, but it kind of sent me down a rabbit hole learning about new BASICs, and so I thought it was cool. And I suspect that it will be relisted. So if you're interested in setting up a classroom for BASIC, then this might be the thing for you if you're really cash-strapped, which I think a lot of classrooms are. So, do you guys know about this particular BASIC? It was new to me.
Nope,
I've never used it.
I have this, but I have not
of course you do.
done anything with it. yeah, it's, but I got it, you know, sort of similarly, because it did seem sort of intriguing to me, like, what could this be? And I hadn't heard about it before I got it, you know, like, so, this is only the second copy I have ever seen.
Yeah, and so I hadn't run across it before, and weird BASICs always catch my eye, because it seems such a strange and difficult thing to try to sell, so I'm always wondering what they're bringing to the table. So anyway, that was my second choice, currently an expired link, but maybe by the time we post this, there'll be a new one, so just, you know, follow this link and there'll be a look at reposted listing or whatever, I'm sure it'll exist. Third thing I'm picking is continuing my theme of hideousness. So I had a couple of news links where I was linking to just disappointingly awful things like Twitter, which is always disappointing and awful, and that terrible website. Well, if you think those were ugly, wait till you check out this one. It's a vintage Apple II in quote-unquote wood grain. It's supposedly not painted, but it's not made of wood.
Yeah, it's like
just some
or
sort
something.
Of tie-dyed, looking like it went through some sort of process, like maybe immersing in something. And it's different looking. So if you want a kind of wood-looking Apple II, then it has two cards that come with it. And the person selling it says, if you put the larger card in, the computer won't start. But that's what they know. You can turn it on and it gives you a white light. And it says, therefore, it's working. $600 buy it now, 4 hours left in it. Is it working? I don't know. It's the strangest thing. There's even a photo of it kind of working where they show the screen come up and have the Apple II, but in the reflection of the screen, they've kind of artfully positioned it. So you look in the monitor and in the reflection, you see the computer itself. So I really like that they have such an ugly computer, but they took a lot of time like setting up a nice photograph. Yeah. So I appreciated the listing. We had a listing last time, which was just like awful and had a black, like out of focus kind of photo. And this person did some really nice photos of a remarkably ugly Apple II. So I liked that combo. So if you want an Apple II that will stand out at Kansas Fest, then this is the one for you. So I picked that
actually,
as my third choice.
It's a clone too. I mean, so neither the motherboard nor the keyboard nor the case are actually Apple products.
Yeah, I wasn't even sure if the case was. Well, no, the case. Actually, you're right, because the lid is definitely not. I was looking because it's got no label on it, but sometimes that could be removed. But yeah, looking at the indentations of the lid, it's definitely not, and on the back. Right. Okay. So some sort of weird clone. It's been through some sort of weird tie dye. I don't know. I kind of like this. Like,
it's interesting.
Computer.
That's for sure.
Yeah. Like you could do worse, right? So. I dig it. It's timeless, is what I'm saying. And then my fourth choice, is what if you've got a Dell Latitude laptop? You know, you're going to be disappointed. Of course you are. Dude, you're getting a Dell. That's a shame for you. And not only do you have a Dell Latitude laptop, you've got one with a non-operational display. So the monitor's busted in it. So you've got your Dell Latitude with a broken monitor. How do you offload that? Well, I'll tell you how you offload it. You set it up as a file server for the TRS-80 Coco and you sell it on eBay. So that's what this person has done. So this is preloaded with everything you need and is being sold as a Coco file server. It's ready to go. You have to use the external monitor port, obviously, because the one that's the built-in display isn't working. They're willing to also reconfigure it to be a Model 1 file server if you prefer, but it's currently set up to be a Cocoa. You get the Dell Latitude, you get a floppy disk, you get the serial cable, a cassette, like all and all documentation, and you're good to go. So you get this kind of broken Dell Latitude, but you get a Cocoa file server. And I thought this was remarkably creative, so I really like this. I'm like, way to go, dude. Or do that. I don't know. But I really like this. I have not seen something like this before. It is terrific.
That is hilarious.
That is very inventive. And I noticed the disk capacity is 20 GMB. I assume that's giga megabytes.
Giga megabytes. Oh, yeah.
Excellent. So exabytes.
That's a lot.
Right? Yeah. It's staggering.
That's very
many
bytes.
Really cool. I caught my eye. I'm like, what is this thing selling? Oh, my gosh. This is great. So, yeah. So those are my choices.
I hope that if anyone does this for a pet, they measure the capacity in petabytes.
I would hope so, too. In what percentage of petabytes?
You know, there's a subreddit called Crackhead Craigslist. This kind of fits the theme of people trying to sell something that is garbage as something else.
Now I want to go look at that site. Yeah. All right, well, I'll go next. I've only got one, and it's an IBM terminal, and I love the way it looks. And if you bought it, it would be, I think, probably nearly useless unless you had some sort of an IBM terminal controller behind it, right? Because didn't these things...
Are you selling those, Earl?
I'm not selling them. I've just spent a lot of miles behind an IBM terminal very close to this one, and I actually like the industrial design. I love the keyboards mm-hmm. that had, you know,
keyboard's great.
About 93 function keys on the top.
Mm-hmm. And typed at 93 decibels.
Yes, right. And very clicky.
As a keyboard should.
It's like a full piano's worth of function keys, right?
Yeah, take that. One row, that's not enough. Give me multiple rows of function keys.
So here's the other interesting thing about this. So I was looking at this and going, oh, nostalgia. I remember what it was like to sit behind one of these things and do programming on the mainframe and that kind of thing. And then I read the description in the eBay auction. It says, removed from working environment 3 weeks ago.
Yeah, 3 weeks ago.
And I'm thinking, wow, there's some place that is the land that time forgot.
Learn COBOL, kids. You'll never not have a job.
Exactly. You won't regret it. Trust me. Actually, you know, that's an interesting thing you say, because I think, honestly, if you know COBOL right now, it's somewhat marketable because all the COBOL people are retiring. So you get this. You get this terminal, you learn
Earl,
COBOL.
Retiring, don't use a euphemism. They're dying. You know they're dying.
Well, you know, that's, okay, retire, expire. I don't.
But it is true that, like, you know, the banks need people who know this stuff.
Yeah,
they
mean,
do.
Like, the world operates on this and Unix.
They do.
And it's nice to sell your services to the place that literally has all the money.
Yeah, that's right.
It's like, let's negotiate my salary. Let's walk in the back room and talk about which percentage of it is mine.
It's surprising what percentage of transactions in that still today go through what we would call legacy systems. So, you know, I think all you need to learn at all is this terminal, right? Well, you need a mainframe. You need a mainframe and this terminal. And then, you know, you're in. So that's my
future is Bitcoin and COBOL.
This seller actually has... a couple of these setups. There's three setups of like with slightly different monitors and a couple of slightly different keyboards, but they're all pretty much the same kind of thing.
I noticed that. I picked the one I liked the best out of the ones that he had.
I know that when I saw this, I went down a little bit of a rabbit hole, remembering that there was a compact keyboard and they're super expensive. I didn't actually list any, I don't think, but these sort of like Model M, you know, buckling spring or whatever you call them, like the clacky keyboards, but a compact version of them, hundreds of, like, you know, $300-$400 to get one of these now. But they're cool. So if you see
well,
one,
and I
don't throw
think
it away.
people people make adapters and that, so you can take some of the keyboards that weren't necessarily designed for a PC, but they're that buckling spring technology, and use them on a PC. I could swear I remember reading about that. You know, because keyboards are a whole thing. I mean, that's a whole collecting niche of its own. But
and actually, the same seller is selling just one of these keyboards at a starting bid of $50.
Mm-hmm.
So just the giant buckling springs with 24 function keys. Man.
You'd be styling.
Office is going to love me.
We're also selling a whole bunch of things from... At first, I got very excited because I'm like, how are you picking these and you're ignoring all their links, all the things they're selling from Space Labs? I'm like, what? But it turns out Space Labs is the name of a medical supply place. But I got very excited about things from Space Labs. I'm like, screw your IBM. What's with the Space Lab thing with the arm? But it's just medical stuff. It's not as exciting as it sounds.
Mm.
Well, you had me going there for a second, Carrington.
Me too.
All right. Well, Paul, you've probably got one or two things here.
Yes, I have a small set. So the first thing I have is an IBM PC Junior computer and keyboard in its boxes. It looks pretty complete. I don't know if this is cheap for these. I saw it. So it's a $109 starting bid, or you can just buy it now for $145. And let's see. To me, shipping is $26. So I looked at this and thought, that doesn't sound like very much. And I thought about buying it, and then I said, well, no, I will list it in the eBay auction section of this to keep me from buying it.
Nice.
Sometimes that works.
The funny thing about these are, like, we just had a discussion about how old IBMs and they're glorious keyboards.
Yeah.
We just love a vintage IBM keyboard, right? You think IBM, you think wonderful keyboard. And then the PC Junior says, hold my beer. Like, look at my keyboard. Look what I brought to the party. Oh, PC Junior. My goodness.
These are amazing. Also, I'm pretty sure that this is the wireless one where you could actually like walk up to somebody else's computer and start typing. So it's bad for office environments. But
depends on the office.
But it looks like it's actually smaller than it's quite small. And it looks like it's in good shape. It has a bunch of stuff. It's not, you know, it's the original owner and it has the boxes in there in basically good shape. So if you were looking for one, yeah, and I think this actually also has composite out. I think you can use a kind of a CGA monitor as well, but if you don't have one, you could even just plug it into whatever, you know, whatever composite thing you have.
Well, yeah, that's what I was thinking. I was like, they say in the auction here, it's not been turned on for over 20 years, so maybe they don't want to chance it, but it's going to be more valuable to people if they know that it works. I mean, you could just plug it into just your standard TV with a composite in. So just note to sellers out there, whenever we see something that says we don't know if it works, assume it doesn't work, that it's broken.
Or if you buy it, you will see this relisted later. Second owner, untested. Sure it is. Slightly smoke damaged.
Yeah, right. Anyway, I thought it was kind of cool. I can't decide what I think about the PC Junior. It does feel like it feels like a machine that had a sort of an impact, even if it wasn't really a positive one.
Oh,
right.
Yeah.
But let's see the next one. I don't know. As I was going through my list, I saw someone was selling an Apple IIc monitor that they posed by a lake on a stump. So I thought that was interesting.
It's very weird because I also wondered, what's special about this? Wait, why is it taken out for a walk to photograph?
Oh, it's not by a lake. It's just by a horizon. But yeah, it's just out in a field.
A field where you can see for like a field of clear cutting or something. Yeah. It's just weird. There's a stump and then just endless acres of nothing.
So these monitors are actually kind of cool, though. I mean, like they're little 9-inch monitors that have a heavy metal stand that they sit on, and like the computer slides in underneath it. They're pretty somewhat iconic looking, I guess.
Yeah. If you have a 2C, it's the monitor to get. Yeah. I like them.
They're nice. They work well. If you don't have to ship it with that heavy metal stand, because it is a very heavy metal stand,
yeah,
then everything's good. But
yeah, the monitor is showing at a bid of $20 for me, and the shipping is $120.
Wow. Really?
That's what eBay's showing me, yep.
That's interesting. To me, it's To me, it's showing, maybe I'm not logged in as me, but it's showing only $53 shipping. But at any rate, it's heavy. But it's got it's a nice looking box and so forth.
It probably costs more to take it over the mountains to Earl.
That's probably what it is.
And you die of dysentery.
Actually, I'll jump ahead to one that I have a little bit later down my list. It's a Apple IIc multi-pack. This is from that Sci-Fi Man seller in Nova Scotia, and I thought this was sort of interesting because it's a packaging that I'd never seen before. So and that's the thing that's interesting about this. It's an Apple IIc. Actually, maybe it doesn't even include the computer. Oh, it does. Okay, so an Apple IIc and the monitor and I think the stand, but all packed together in a box that says Apple IIc multi-pack. So the individual components inside this are not rare in the least. But the thing that's interesting about this is the fact that it is in a box that contained them all. So this is not something I knew about it, that it was possible to buy this particular package. So I've learned something today.
It's also weirdly packed because if you look at how it goes into the outer box, like the various items, the monitor seems to only get styrofoam protecting it on one side. It can't have shipped that way. It's very weird.
It is kind of bizarre, particularly because the styrofoam seems to be on the inside.
Right. Oh, but you could reverse it. Maybe it was supposed to be on the side, but then it would clack against you. The whole thing seems very strange to me. Yeah. But yeah, I also did not know about this multi-pack. Yeah.
It's quite possible that it is not worth $400 to get a box that says multi-pack on it.
The seller of this is actually Lilu Dallas.
Oh.
Deep cut there, folks.
Sorry. What?
Lilu Dallas multi-pack.
Multi-pass.
It's a Fifth Element joke. Going over big.
No, I keep meaning to rewatch that because people say it was good.
It is good.
When I watched it the first time, I don't know.
Oh, no. Fifth Element
is keep watching
not,
until you like it.
It's not a movie you watch once and go, oh, I got that, because you didn't. Trust me. 15 times
is great.
You can be part of the club.
All right. Yeah. No, I'll watch it again, but...
I love that movie. It's an inside joke in our house. If we get like a new credit card or something like that in the mail, we'll look at each other and go, multi-pass. But only Fifth Element people will get that. So,
very cool.
I've seen the movie once a long time ago, and I don't remember this multi-pass thing. But I guess I have to watch it again.
Watch it again. Yep.
Let's see. So what else? I have next thing, IBM printer stand in the IBM theme. There's nothing much to this. It's sort of a, like, I don't know what you call this, but it's sort of like a smoke plastic, you know, just little thing that the printer sits on and the paper goes underneath it. But it says IBM. It has a little IBM logo on it. It's kind of cool.
And you can see the reflection of the Christmas tree of the person who did the photos.
Yeah.
I love these things. And just like the Mac stand for the iconic little toaster Macs, the little swivel stands, these come up quite a bit. And they're always so much money, I don't understand it. How is this $80 for a bed piece of plastic?
Yeah. But it has the box, too, which
I don't
is
understand
cool.
This. Yeah, but I don't want the box. I want to put my computer on it.
Right.
Same thing with Mac stands. Stands are so much money. You think 3D printing would have destroyed the market with these things. But I guess people want originals.
Yeah. I had one, I'm kind of sad about this, I had one that was a digital on it. It was a lot like this. It was not sloped. It didn't have a curve in the front, but it was, it said digital and it was kind of neat. But, you know, you remember those towers of boxes?
Yes.
yeah, that was a casualty of box collapse at one point. So
I was just thinking, of course it was square if it was digital, because the analog ones are rounded off.
Of course. Exactly.
Oh, my jokes are just getting better by the minute.
I think it's possible to find a very old IBM cheese slicer. Speaking of rounded.
What?
Because I think they existed like way back before they were doing computers or anything like that. They were, you know, business machines of some sort, and this was a cheese slice measurer thing.
Yep. I just Googled it, and there is indeed...
So
I'll be the IBM cheese slicer.
Non-digital. I have seen one of those on eBay a long time ago, but maybe there's one now. Who knows? The next thing I have is it is a Super 8 color sound 17-minute excerpt of The Empire Strikes Back. which was listed in the vintage computer section. So here it is.
Super 8 videos are so weird. This was a whole thing where you could buy movies, but you know, there's only 17 minutes on the reel or whatever, so you get that version of a movie. Just crazy.
So I think maybe with the new Star Wars movies, that would be good. Because I think you could actually probably...
Actually, 17 minutes is more than enough to get all the good bits from the prequels.
Yes.
And have like 15 minutes left over of just George Lucas apologizing.
Yeah, anyway, I think it's... I thought this was sort of interesting. I don't have a way to play it. But even though it is incorrectly listed in the vintage computing section, it is kind of a neat thing that I... You know, it's the best of the movies, or best of the Nineology or whatever it is, right?
Inglorious... Super 8.
Exactly. With sound.
Which might say color, but color would be in quotes because they are so washed out in Super 8. It's like basically the colors are black and cyan. There's your colors.
Yeah, that's true. They did. There are some screen, like I guess photographs of the screen,
right,
being screened and
there are. Yeah, look at that.
It's very amber or whatever that is.
Sepia toned.
Yeah.
Heavy sepia filter.
Next thing. So I thought this was sort of interesting. This is a set of TS 2068 updates. And it's not entirely for the Timex Sinclair 2068, but it is it's like a Sinclair newsletter that went on for a long time. So it was from 1987 to 1996.
My goodness.
All 36 issues. One thing I noticed when I observed who the seller was, and knowing that made me know that these have been scanned. So if you are going to get these, you don't need to get them. They don't need to be saved. And in fact, actually, we'll put in the show notes a link to the Internet Archive. Maybe it's not this person's scan, but they are scanned. But one thing that's kind of cool about this is that if you get the real ones, so if you want the real ones to hold in your hand and read, you can get them. They actually do kind of look a little nicer than the scans, but they're also in color. You know, they have like color covers that didn't seem to have been scanned. So you can appreciate the color, and you can appreciate the fact that there was in 1996 a Timex Sinclair update newsletter.
I love this style of desktop publishing. Like, it's just, it's great. It's super lovely and very zine-like. Mm-hmm. I dig it. Mm-hmm. I dig it a lot. There is no such thing as too many fonts on a page. And I think this person has embraced that philosophy to an extent that I can appreciate. I love it.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, it's pretty cool. I'm actually, now that I know that this exists, I'm actually kind of curious to read it because I don't know what to do with the Timex 2068. I mean, it's not quite compatible with the Spectrum.
Ah, the phrase "not quite compatible." Yes, just lovely. The key to hours and hours of fun.
Yes. Okay, let's see. Only a couple more things. There is if you want to buy, what I wrote in the show notes is urgent C64 case. It is a red painted Redmond case.
I wonder what you meant by urgent. It is fire engine. That's great. Actually, that looks really nice.
I do like it. And I think it is, from what I read here, it is an original case that was painted. It's not like newly fabricated.
That's a great color choice. Painted the inside out, everything. It's a really good paint job. Yep. I dig it. I think that looks really sharp.
Starting bid is $70 and price is $130 to buy it now, but it's almost worth it, I would say.
That color.
Okay, penultimate thing. An Amiga DC TV unit. I don't think the seller really knows what this is, but
I don't know what it is.
Jack, do you know what it is?
The DC TV rings a bell, I think, but...
So it's what I discovered about it is that it is a video capture device.
Okay.
So it allows you to, I think within 10 seconds, you can capture a frame of video.
Woohoo!
You plug it into, I think, both the serial and the video port. And I think, actually, it does, there may be some output thing that can do as well. But I thought it was kind of interesting just as an object.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be kind of fun to get one and use it twice. But I don't know.
Right. So it looks like it has a video in, and it connects to the computer. Yeah, so it's like, say you plug in the output from your DVD player or your VCR or camera or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
and it will capture that and save it on the computer, I guess.
Yeah. And I think I saw something about it. Like, it could sort of play video, but only if you had a megabyte of memory in your Amiga. So.
Right. Interesting.
Yeah. Anyway, it's interesting. And so if you want to bid on this, it is $45 starting bid, which seems, you know, it doesn't sound like a lot. I bet it sold for a lot more originally.
Oh, I'm sure. This cost hundreds. Yeah, it looks like it's shiny and not stained, and like it probably works.
Mm-hmm.
Probably works like that.
Well, it probably doesn't have too many components to fail.
But. Right.
Or if they do fail, they fail so slowly you don't notice.
That's right.
Every 10 seconds, no.
Okay, I see what your link is there.
I'm having fun in our show notes.
Okay.
There's a Canadian version of the DCTV. I'll leave that as an exercise to the listener. Yeah. Go on our show notes, you can see that.
Okay, and then the last thing I have. I thought that this is interesting. It might actually be cheap, but it appears to be an original, unbuilt ZX81 computer kit.
Nice!
So if you read the description, it says, I formed my company in February of 1983 to support Timex Sinclair Computers. I had 5 employees then and designed, manufactured, and sold hardware add-ons for the various Timex and Sinclair computers. So this is like a development kit, something that the guy had, I guess, you know, for developing for this. But it's got a really nice-looking box. Everything is in really excellent shape. I mean, like, it would almost be a tragedy to build it.
Yeah, I think you shouldn't build it. I mean, this is, he says it's museum quality. And I think instead, like, displaying this in a way to say, like, here's how the kit and the components were is better than building it. There's a lot of these out there. This is really nice.
Yeah. And it does not, for what it is, it really does not feel very expensive. So it's quite possible that it won't last very long.
No,
because Paul's going to buy it.
I think it's pretty reasonable. It's interesting. I looked where the seller was, and it shows New York. I remember a long time ago, there was a website where you could get the ZX81s new in the box, unbuilt, and they were just selling them. And they had quite a few of them, actually. And you could just get on and buy one. And then, you know, they presumably ran out and that went away. But that was New York as well. I don't know if it's any relation, but... is the only place that I knew of, you know, the latest place where you could get one of the unbuilt kits.
Oh, actually, yeah. When I Googled that, it looks like there's a Sinclair ZX81 computer kit, $499. And the photos in this link on Zebra Systems, at least one of them is the photo from this eBay auction.
Hmm.
Showing the same books, the same everything. So this must be one of those kits?
So it's
seems very interesting. Strange to me.
Well, now, should we be suspicious? I don't know.
Don't be suspicious. Don't be suspicious.
How is it? How's it cheaper on eBay than out in there? Well, anyway, we'll check that out. But
yeah.
It's cool though, because I really, apart from what you just said, I had not expected very many of these to still be out there in the world.
Yeah,
I think that what you found, this Zebra Systems, is this.
Oh, it is them.
It's the same site that I'd seen forever ago.
Right, and it looks like they were selling them, and this is they've got a few left. Okay, it is that same person. Even on the Zebra System site, it says currently selling them with everything pictured on eBay. So it looks like they originally were selling these for $4.99 on eBay and probably only have a few left, and they're discounted to $3.99. Okay, less suspicious.
Very cool.
Cool. Right.
Perfect.
Well, so if you're interested, hurry up.
Also, this is like a if they're not like the last one left like that, this is a fun gift guide idea too. Give somebody a kit for Christmas.
Yeah, that's true.
Mm-hmm.
There is someone put this the Tynemouth software one in the show notes.
That was me. I've had good luck with Tynemouth products, and so have other people that I've talked to in the Commodore community. The interesting thing is that fairly recently, actually, they started offering a ZX81 compatible computer kit. So if you want to build one of these suckers from scratch and you don't want to pay $400 for it, then you could go to Time Mouse Software. The link that I put was for their Tindy store, but if you go over to their blog, you can read about the making of, you know, how all this came about. They had a ZX80 compatible one for quite a while, and now they've got an 81 also.
Cool. So this also might be a fun kit project to give somebody.
Yeah.
And in the
cool.
end, you'll have a ZX81.
Yeah, more power than you know what to do with.
Well, you put one of those covers over it to make it look like a 64. Right.
But the keys definitely don't line up. All right. Well, was that it?
That was it. Yep.
Did we get through it? I'm, nice.
I'm done.
Nice. We
did it.
We did a show, guys. This is exciting. Woo.
Check it out on YouTube. Oh, wait.
Next time. Next time we'll figure that out.
Sorry, guys.
Yeah. Why not?
Actually, it wasn't our fault. Promise. In fact, it's probably working even now, but it probably was working 1 minute
fault.
After we started recording.
Yeah, actually, I got a message from StreamYard about halfway through this saying, problem fixed now. It should be working again.
Cool. Oh, bummer. All
right.
Oh, well. Well, just in time.
We'll try again in 2 weeks.
Yep. Yep. 2 weeks from now, we'll do it. Our pre-Christmas show.
Yeah.
All right. So let's do parting shots. Carrington, I'll start with you. Anything?
I got nothing.
Nothing to
add? Snowing like crazy here. I want to move. My 2 weeks from now, we'll be doing this on video, and you'll look behind me and see Costa Rica, hopefully. Got it. Almost certainly not.
Oh. Well, it's comforting to know you're up there in Toronto. I don't know why. It just is.
Taking one for the team.
But someone, you know, whose weather is worse.
Yeah,
that you can feel better than.
There you go. That's right. I'm not the last guy. What about you, Paul? Parting shots?
Oh, yeah. No, I also similarly have a little bit of snow. The real world work has just been nonstop. So any moment now we'll be at the academic break between semesters, and maybe then I'll get some interesting stuff to talk about.
Hmm. Yeah, the work thing. I know that one. Mine has been like crazy times too, but I think it's gonna slow down just a little in December, so I might actually get a little bit of retro time in. So what about you, Jack? Closing thoughts? Why don't you land this plane?
Well, a couple things. I got a new S Drive Max for the Atari 8-bits. This is one of these SD card solutions, and this one is pretty cool because it's got a little screen. Looks like a little roughly 3-inch screen, and the whole thing is sitting in a box that's designed to look like an Atari 1050 drive, but way, way, way smaller. And you can set this up and plug it in and boot off disk images and whatnot. And then while the computer is running, you can use the display to navigate around and switch disks, that sort of thing. So it looks pretty neat. I haven't tried it yet. It looks like this is going to be a lot more user-friendly than the previous solution I had, or which I still have. But I will try this one out and probably...
Nice.
I think I'm going to like it better. It seems like I will like it better. And I also got recently, just today, in fact, I picked it up, a book that I got in a Kickstarter called The Unofficial Atari Visual History. This is published by a guy named Darren Doyle, Gray Fox Books. And I signed up for this Kickstarter back in like February, March or something, and it arrived now. And that's the way it is with Kickstarter. But it's very cool because this thing is like, I don't know, it's a big, fat, hardcover book. I'm going to say it's 300 or 400 pages, I don't know. And it is full color, the whole dang thing. So as I flip through, almost every open pair of pages is talking about one game, where usually a screenshot on the right, some text about it, a photo of the cover art. It's really, really cool. I really, really dig this book. So I'm happy with that. And as a perk that I ordered along with when I did the Kickstarter, they had mouse pads, so I now have in my little hands a mouse pad that is designed to look like the membrane keyboard of Atari 400.
Nice.
Excellent. Put it on top of your dust cover on your Commodore 64.
That's right.
And a flat mouse pad is a perfect way to do a 400 keyboard.
Exactly. So it just makes sense.
Are you sure it isn't actually an Atari 400 keyboard?
Inside there.
I've seen other mouse pads with that design. Maybe in fact the same. You know, I don't know if it's from someone different or not, but they look really good. I mean,
yeah,
I really like the color scheme and everything. It's
Yep. I'm looking at the Kickstarter right now, and that is a great looking mouse pad.
Yep.
Nice.
Yeah, it looks really nice, and the book is really nice, and yeah, I know. It was weird. I noticed because I signed up for the Kickstarter, and on the Facebook page for this back in the spring, the author of this was getting a lot of negativity from people, and I don't really understand why. I try to not get involved in controversies that I do not understand. So I ignored all that and just like, okay, I've ordered my book. We'll see how it is when it comes. I think it looks great. I think it looks really cool. I don't know when I've had a 400 page book that is every single page is full of color except for like graphic novels. But anyway, super cool. I'm very happy.
Nice. I have a question for you on the S-Drive Max. Did you get the one assembled or did you get the kit?
Yes, I got the one assembled. And this came from, what's it called? Vintage Computer Center. I forget the guy's name. He was offering this for sale on one or several of the Facebook groups for the Atari 8-bit computers.
Okay.
So it's the same. The 3D design is the one designed by Steve Boswell, I think is his name. So he's made his designs available for everyone to use.
Cool.
And this one is nicely printed with a couple different colors and has even a little sort of metal band across the top. So the 1050 has a metal band across the top that says Atari 1050. This one has a little tiny metal band that says Atari 1050S. S for small, I guess. So
sweet.
It's pretty cool. If we had our video going, guys, I was going to show you all this stuff, but no.
But no. You can still show us. We'll imagine.
Yes.
Yeah, paint a word picture.
Hold it up to your microphone. For those of you listening in black and white, the S-Drive Max
is... This is what it sounds like when I bang the microphone with it. Now picture that.
Yes. Sounds nice and solid.
That does sound like 400 pages.
Well made.
No, that was the S-Drive Max. Here's the book.
Oh, yes, you're right.
I think we have an entire new show. Jack bangs thing on his microphone, and we all have to guess what it is. What's my line for vintage computers? I dig it.
Well, nice. You got to let me know about the S-Drive Max. I always hear the Antic guys talking about that. Kevin Savitz. There, I got it in. All right. Well, I think that wraps us up. That's it for this show. You can find the show notes for all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss us in the forums at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php, where you'll find all the Vintage Computer Federation-y people talking. It's a great discussion forum about all things retro computing. You can find RCR on Twitter at RCR Podcast. You can join our Facebook group, as many, many hundreds of people have, at facebook.com/groups/RCR Podcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com, where you can let us know, in your opinion, which vintage games stand the test of time. We're a member of the Throwback Network. We'll have a link for that up in the show notes as well. If you like the show, please write a review for us on iTunes, because that does something or other. And until next time,
Retro Compute!